going down these very steep sides till you get to the bottom. And then you hike some distance across the bottom of this crater, and then you come to this big, huge hole that goes very, very deep down into the earth. And you could look in and you could see like steam and smoke coming out and little glimmers of red down there. So the guides told us that down in this crater lived Pele, who was the fire goddess, you know, of the ancient Hawaiians. So all around there were these pieces of spun volcanic glass, and they said, this is Pele's hair. And there were these little droplets of green, you know, volcanic glass, and they said, those are Pele's tears. And they said, there's a form of worship. Yes, they gave us bananas and had us offer them into this fire pit for satisfaction of this goddess Pele. Then, when it was all over, and we were out of the volcano, they gave everybody a little certificate, and it had a picture of this goddess on it, Pele, with her flaming hair, and the certificate said, you know, now that you've performed the austerity of, you know, going down into this volcano and performing this worship, then, you know, the goddess Pele grants you a benediction that whenever you go into the realm of volcanoes, you will be protected. So, about 20 years later, I found myself in Iceland. I was in the United States Navy at the time, and I was stationed at a weather outpost in this very desolate island that's located up by the Arctic Circle, kind of between, you know, between Europe and Greenland. So one day I heard there was a volcano erupting on Iceland. It's a volcano called Hekla. It's actually a famous volcano in Europe. They used to think back in the Middle Ages in Europe that it was the gateway to hell. You know, that you would go down to, you know, hell there. There was some famous book written by some science fiction author, Jules Verne, Journey to the Center of the Earth, where, you know, they went down, you know, this volcano to the center of the earth. When you look at it, it's like a big low mountain in the middle of a black sand desert, which is all this volcanic ash that's fallen over the course of many thousands of years. And there's no real road, so some friends of mine and I rented a Land Rover truck, and we, you know, just drove up to this volcano. And we parked a couple miles away from it, and, you know, from the side of it, it wasn't that it was, you know, like erupting or anything, but from the side of it, there's this sort of flow of lava coming out. Very, very wide, just sort of like a little river of this lava. So we went and looked at that. And then we went to take our lunch, and we sat down on a hill, you know, near this, you know, not the big mountain itself, but a hill sort of right before it. And I remember sitting there, and then the ground just sort of, you know, like felt like it dropped about a foot, you know, out from under us. And so we ran off the hill and we just started running. And then my friends and I, we ran about like a mile, and then we turned around and looked, and the very hill on which we were sitting exploded. Went boom, and a huge cloud of smoke just went 10 or 20,000 feet into the air, and it just started erupting. We were actually present when a major volcanic eruption started. So then we were sitting there looking at this, this fantastic sight. And then I pulled out my little certificate. I had gotten 20 years before and showed it to my friends, this benediction from the goddess Pele, that if I ever went into the realm of volcanoes, I'd be protected. So, in any case, whether this goddess had any role in that or not, still, it's even if she did exist and did do something at that time, still couldn't save me from the cycle of birth and death. Because these demigods, no matter how powerful they are, they're also subject to the material laws, because they're material, they have material bodies. Any benediction, they have some control by the arrangement of Krishna. They're empowered to control certain forces of nature. Of course, then you have Brahma, who's in charge of manifesting the entire universe, and is in charge of manifesting all the different forms of life too. So some of them are quite powerful, and there's stories of different demons in the Krishna book, Srimad Bhagavatam, who would approach even Brahma, the most powerful demigod, and try to get benedictions from him, like Hiranyakashipu being one example. We'll talk about these things later more in depth. But this phenomenon of demigod worship, again, it's something that's still very prominent in the world today. I'm trying to get a copy of the most recent issue of Back to Godhead magazine, because there's a nice exchange in there between Jayadvaita Swami and the president of some Hindu student organization at Oxford University in England. They're talking about the demigod issue, which is becoming a very heavy issue, because people want to know, well, why Krishna? Why are you just insisting on Krishna? Aren't we all Hindus, and can't we just worship? I can worship Shiva, and you can worship Indra, and you can worship Krishna, and it's all the same. Now, that idea is very prominent. And actually, Back to Godhead magazine has become a little bit controversial, because they ran a series of articles last year explaining what the position of the demigods really is. That we can see them, we can respect them as devotees of the Lord, empowered representatives of the Lord, but they're not on the same level as the Lord himself. There's actually a Vedic mantra that says that one who sees Brahma, Shiva, and others, other demigods, on the same, to be the same as the Supreme Lord, Vishnu, they're to be considered a kind of atheist, really. Pashandis, offenders. So, it's actually quite a serious issue. It's something we're bound to encounter in our preaching efforts. And then also, just historically speaking, it's very interesting. Before Christianity took over in Europe, most of those people were demigod worshippers of one kind or another. It's still reflected even in the English days of the week, which are named after different Norse demigods. And then you have, of course, the Greek and Roman demigods, and devotees sometimes ask Srila Prabhupada, are these kind of related to the Vedic demigods? And Prabhupada would say, yes, similar kind of worship, you know, going on there. And then when Christianity came in, they kind of wiped out all these demigod worshippers in Europe, kind of many times by just pure military force. Kind of wiped them out, destroyed their temples, and you know, did things like that. Of course, in the very early days of Christianity, they had a concept of angels. In these days in Christianity, the concept of angels is sort of watered down from what it originally was. When most people in the Christian countries think of angels these days, they just think of, you know, some nice, sort of like apsaras or gandharvas, sort of little spiritual creatures that play harps, and you know, they don't really have so big a role. But if you look back into some of the early Christian writings, like of Origen and other thinkers like that, you'll see that their concept of the demigods was, of the angels, was more like, you know, the Vedic demigods, that they were kind of empowered representatives of God, some of them very powerful. You know, there were different levels of them. You know, they had hierarchies of these, and some were in charge of the sun, some of the moon, you know, some of the in charge of the different forces of nature. But sort of as Christianity developed, they kind of got rid of all that. And, you know, they're sort of left with just an idea of a very remote, distant God, and then nature down here, which was not, you know, very directly controlled by God or any other spiritual beings. And sort of my theory, anyways, that kind of prepared the way for materialistic science to come in, sort of take over, you know, all the visible parts of reality, you know, and say, well, there may be a God up there somewhere, but everything down here is simply going on by the laws of physics and chemistry, and like that. So this idea of demigod worship, historically it's there in many parts of the world. You know, the great classical cultures of Europe and, you know, the Middle East, you know, the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Greeks and the Romans and the Norse people and the Celtic peoples, they were all worshippers of demigods, one kind or another. It's originally there in Christianity itself, in the form of these very powerful angels in charge of different forces of nature. And of course, it's very, you know, it's very thoroughly explained in Bhagavad Gita and the various, you know, Vedic literatures. You see, there's so much information given about these demigods. So, and again, it's something we definitely encounter in our preaching among those who call themselves Hindus, you know, people of Indian extraction. So, as usual, I'd sort of like to hear any experiences that any of you have had with this phenomenon of demigod worship. Have any of you encountered this in your preaching activities? Do you ever run into it? Yeah.
I was kind of really worship both of you. So from the background, kind of a part of believing.
Yeah.
It was like part of the belief. you believe that the demigod has some type of supreme God, as supposed to kind of like pay them or offer them or offer them something of respect.
But then how would at that time in your life, then how were you relating to Vishnu or Krishna at that time? Just one among many. But would you go to certain of them for certain purposes, or
didn't
think about it too much? It was just something you were aware of. That's
That's what you were brought up to believe. Until up until the point you come to Krishna.
Where were you born? What part of in South Africa? So there are the people, the Indian people in South Africa were maintaining like demigod worship. Do they have temples, or was that
lots of
temples? But to what specific gods they had?
Like you get different types of kingdoms, you know, different people pray for different reasons also. It's
yeah.
Not that actually understand Krishna is supreme. It's very complicated. I mean, lots of people, they all have different motives. Like you know, okay, Ganesh is for, you know, you need some. Some of these remove obstacles, you clear path, you pray to him. You need some power or something, you pray to Hanuman. Like that. Like they know the idea behind it, but I think because of the... because as time is going by, they starting to accept these figures as the supreme.
Right.
And this one comes in all the way.
But then they didn't want liberation, right? They didn't want
it's like they want something material, some material
gain. Right. Yes.
I didn't have that experience, but I went to my Indian school, 6 years old, with the students. And I found that they were confused that what should be doing is actually what they were doing. That's what I just said. They didn't understand exactly what they were doing.
You went to a Hindu school? So you went there when you were growing up?
Yeah, I was, you know, the last 6 years of my high school, and sometimes I would go to them, go with them.
Uh-huh. Go to a temple with them?
Yeah, once or twice. I went to a mosque or something.
Uh-huh.
To see my friends, how they worship.
Mm.
But I wasn't impressed at all, but they worship. Because they couldn't explain why they were doing it.
Yeah, well this is it's actually quite a big issue that I think ISKCON, you know, Krishna consciousness movement can shed some light on, you know, help people really understand what, because it's not that these demigods aren't there, they're there. They're real, they have some role to play in the universe, but it really has to be understood, you know, what their position is in relationship to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it's not just some theoretical thing that we'll read about, you know, in Bhagavad Gita, you know, about things that were happening thousands of years ago. It's still this question of, you know, the relationship of the demigods to a supreme god, you know, is is something that's very much with us today. Very much so. Somebody else? Keshav and Priya?
When I was about 12, 13 years old, I read a book and it was entitled They Call Me Ganesh. And somehow or other, you know, it was a story about an English boy who was raised up in a Hindu family and, you know, was also practicing yoga and, you know, Ganesh worship. And everything was explained in detail, how to do it and the whole thing. And I remember that this boy, somehow or other, he was, by meditating on Brahman and, you know, praying to Ganesh, he was able to stay like for minutes underwater and practice some siddhis and stuff like that. And I used to do swimming competition at that time. So I used to have training every day after school, you know, for a few hours. And I remember I was trying to do what was told in the book and, you know, practicing, and I would swim like 150 meters underwater without, you know, anything. And just by meditating
on Ganesh.
On Ganesh and praying to him and, you know, looking for the picture. And I would pray to Ganesh every day, like for a year or so, and then
you know. You're working.
Yeah, she said it worked. She was able to swim further underwater. But actually, that's, of course, we're all kind of swimming underwater, you know. We're in a very unnatural condition. But sooner or later, we're going to have to come up for air. Yeah. Well, what happens on book distribution when you need someone?
I need them, and you know, and I try to present, I don't directly present, I tell them this is the books, try to get them to take the books, and often they say, well, look at what they get. They have to, because we know what we're using. But then I try to explain that, you know, this is part of the deal of Krishna. And they don't like the idea of Krishna supreme.
Yeah, that's they don't like. They don't like that.
I remember I was in one big shopping mall and I met this Indian man. I read this to him, and he said, "You people, why do you push Krishna supreme? She let us do that." And he just pushed my books and they just went away. Very sad. So I think they do like that. They are very stuff. Specifically, Shiva. They think that Shiva is God, the supreme God. This is many people. They are very disturbed.
Yeah.
In Sai Baba, one day, he actually showed me a picture of the lotus feet of Sai Baba. He said, "This is my God."
Yeah. Well, see, this is very important because actually, the Krishna consciousness movement is meant to challenge, you know, these different ideas. You know, like, you know, the demigods are supreme. Brahman is supreme. Material nature is supreme. You know, like atheism is supreme. You know, just like we've been seeing. So, the purpose of the Krishna consciousness movement actually is to show the superiority of bhakti, devotion to Krishna, over all these other competing systems. Dharma projito kaitava tra. You know, it says in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it kicks out all the other, you know, varieties of cheating religion. Of course, one has to be, you know, a little expert. One can't be fanatic in the way that one approaches these things. But nevertheless, if we look at the history of Vaishnavism, you know, the great acharyas in Vaishnavism, they stood up for Krishna. You know, they presented forceful arguments against the Mayavadis. You know, Krishna is speaking out very strongly. I mean, Krishna himself is speaking out very strongly, as we'll see about, you know, like the demigod worshippers, you know, what their position actually is. So, I mean, this is something to keep in mind that, and we all have, according to our, you know, different positions, some role to play in this, because this, say, if, I mean, there's so many facets of Krishna consciousness, but say if we were going to say, well, what things would we want to, if we're all going to be gone, you know, in a few years, and then what do we want the next generation of devotees to understand as the important principles of Krishna consciousness? And I think one of them would have to be the primary importance of this missionary activity, you know, of spreading Krishna consciousness in the world in opposition to all these other ideas, you know, that are out there, showing the superiority of Krishna consciousness, you know, and it's whether by book publication or speaking or other means. So I think that would be one thing that we would want to communicate, not that we're just going to be content to be one, all right, well, we've got our idea, they've got theirs, and all right, you know, live and let live, and you know, it's not like that. So Veda Vyas, a great, you're great in honor of your great namesake, who wrote those words.
My surprise that I had to give a class. I wasn't preaching about the disciple or some other.
There was
25
businessmen. They
were all Hindus. And he says, you give class. And it's continuously I have to give class because an interesting thing for me. I just
give the body. Who asked you to give class? When he would
come up in the
short. Okay. So he was there and he just said, you talk.
Yeah.
So you had to do it. Okay.
So it was a big disaster. Because I gave the class and everything was fine, everybody was happy. But one of the devotees says, who is the supreme? So one man says, Shiva is the supreme. And one of the other says, Krishna is the supreme. And then everybody started yelling at each other. There was about half and half grand. And the other one started about fist fight. It was like a big. So the issue is very, very tense among the Hindus.
Yes. Yes. Yes, there is.
Another thing is, I went to travel in the States, through the distribution, and I came in contact with, I wanted to be and live with the American Indian community. You heard the Navajos, the Hopis.
Yeah.
The Hopis.
Yeah.
So I went to live with the Hopis for about 5-6 years ago.
As part of your book distribution training.
Sure was. So, they were very friendly people. But I started inquiring more about their belief in Astrobiology. They got this thing, you know, each, like, we went to see the oldest village in America, still people living in these broken down houses.
Yeah.
And on the roof, I saw some chief, and you see these eagles, and big eagles, and they all tied up.
Not real painted. Ones, live ones, yeah. Not paintings. Big eagles tied up, okay.
They tied up, and then they feed them. And after a while, they offer them a sacrifice to the Kachinas. The Kachinas is their demigods. And they uncharted the rain. Because of them, if they please with them, then they provide all the wonderful facilities. And they're very powerful civilization in one sense, because you can take a grain of maize and corn, and you can take a grain of corn, and you can take over each grain of corn. And when you put it in the ground in the desert, the corn grows to be a life-size, normal-size,
yeah.
You know, it was very interesting. So, so what I found that the best way, I was preaching to them, I was just telling them that we're going in every town and village in America, and we're doing a sacrifice that will please God, and this will bring all prosperity for all of you. So I would put the village, come back to the chief, and return our Krishna. We all have to do that. So after 2 weeks, we didn't realize it because I'm from Vancouver, and Vancouver there's so much rain.
Uh-huh.
But after 2 weeks in summertime, we realized that there was rain every day, at least for 1 minute.
Wait, now say that again. There was rain?
We realized that we were in the desert.
Yeah.
And there was rain every single day. We didn't hurry up in those minutes.
Oh, that's fantastic.
At least 1 minute. One minute. But this is very, very dangerous worship they do. Because they have some people from Mexico that comes and they dress like Kachinas. Which is, they dress themselves like sorcerer, you can say.
Yeah.
From their dances. And very, very amazing. I didn't see them, but it was all sacrificed and they had a flute dance and they had different kind of dance. And one of the dance they do is that there's a kibbutz, which is like a cave.
Yeah.
And they pray one, they fast 4 days, one day north, one day south, one day east, one day west. And the fourth day after this, they go in the cave, and there's a bunch of snakes there. And they can go there, and you can put the snakes in the mouth, because the snake will bite them, but they may get bitten. And if they don't get bitten, they come out successfully, then you have mystic power, and you can help the community there.
Yeah. So this is one of the features of this demigod worship, that it often involves very, you know, kind of grotesque and dangerous. It's like, even in Vedic times, we see that when they wanted to get the attention of Lord Shiva, you know, what was that? What, he'd be cutting his own flesh off. Who is that that was doing that? What was his name? The demon who was cutting his own flesh to get the attention of Shiva.
It may come.
It should come for all of us. We have to have a course on Krishna book. And then of course, you know, you have Hiranyakashipu, you know, like just sitting in a
what?
Yeah, Vritrasura. Yeah, okay. Oh, you didn't say it loud enough. Okay. Yeah. Who did?
Rama. He offered his head. He had 10 heads. He offered one offered and a head. Lord Shiva.
Yeah.
And then later on, Lord Shiva testified and gave benediction to Lord Shiva.
So I think this is one of the disadvantages of this kind of worship. You know, it's I think, you know, the sacrifice of chanting Hare Krishna and taking prasadam is a little easier, I think. So I want to go over some of the text in Bhagavad Gita that deal with this phenomenon. And so tomorrow, as I said, I'm trying to get a copy of this Back to Godhead magazine that has this nice exchange between, you know, like Jayadwaita Swami and the, you know, president of this Hindu organization. Because it shows, you know, how one can preach on this point very nicely, you know, not compromise, but still do it very nicely and effectively. So, we go to let's start with 3:10, chapter 3, text 10. So there, text 10 of this chapter, which is called Karma Yoga, Krishna saying, Sahayagya Praja Srishtva Purovacha Prajapati Anena Prasavishtyadvam Eshavostishtakam Juk. In the beginning of creation, the Lord of creatures sent forth generations of men and demigods along with sacrifices for Vishnu and blessed them by saying, be thou happy by this yajna sacrifice, because its performance will bestow upon you everything desirable for living happily and achieving liberation. Then in the next verse, text 11, Krishna says, Devan bhava yatanena te deva bhava yantuva parasparam bhava yanta shreya param avapsyata. The translation, the demigods, being pleased by sacrifices, will also please you. And thus, by cooperation between men and demigods, prosperity will reign for all. So now these days, you know, people, they try to artificially create, you know, prosperity. You know, they're not observing this system that Krishna has set up, that if you perform sacrifice for Vishnu, then the demigods will be pleased and they'll give all the benedictions that are needed for human society to run very nicely. So they're trying to do things in their own way, and I think I mean, they're just making a big mess out of it, really. When you go to the places, you know, whether it's in India or other parts of the world, these huge industrial cities, you know, they're just terrible places, just crush the human spirit. But Srila Prabhupada, in his purport to this chapter 3, text 11, sort of explains the system. He says, the demigods are empowered administrators of material affairs. The supply of air, light, water, and all other benedictions for maintaining the body and soul of every living entity is entrusted to the demigods, who are innumerable assistants in different parts of the body of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Their pleasures and displeasures are dependent on the performance of yajñas by the human being. Some of the yajñas are meant to satisfy particular demigods, but even in so doing, Lord Vishnu is worshipped in all yajñas as the chief beneficiary. It is stated also in the Bhagavad Gita that Krishna himself is the beneficiary of all kinds of yajñas, boktaram yajña tapasam. Therefore, ultimate satisfaction of the yajña pati, yeah, that's Krishna, is the chief purpose of all yajñas. When these yajñas are perfectly performed, naturally, the demigods in charge of the different departments of supply are pleased, and there is no scarcity in the supply of natural products. Performance of yajñas has many side benefits, ultimately leading to liberation from material bondage. By performance of yajñas, all activities become purified, as is stated in the Vedas, ahara shudhau, sattva shudhi, sattva shudhau, dhruva smriti, smriti lambe, sarvagrantinam vipramokshaha. By performance of yajna, one's eatables become sanctified, and by eating sanctified foodstuffs, one's very existence becomes purified. By the purification of existence, finer tissues of the memory become sanctified, and when memory is sanctified, one can think of the path of liberation. And all these combined together lead to Krishna consciousness, the great necessity of present-day society. And in text 12, Ishtan Bhogan Hivo Deva, Dasyante Yajna Bhavitaha, Tire Datan Apradayabhyo, Yo Bhumte Stena Eva Sa. This is very important. In charge of the various necessities of life, the demigods, being satisfied by the performance of yajna sacrifice, will supply all necessities to you. But he who enjoys such gifts without offering them to the demigods in return is certainly a thief. And in his purport, Srila Prabhupada explains, the demigods are authorized supplying agents on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu. Therefore, they must be satisfied by the performance of prescribed yajñas. In the Vedas, there are different kinds of yajñas prescribed for different kinds of demigods, but all are ultimately offered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. For one who cannot understand what the Personality of Godhead is, sacrifice to the demigods is recommended. According to the different material qualities of the persons concerned, different types of yajna are recommended in the Vedas. Worship of different demigods is also on the same basis, namely according to the different qualities. For example, the meat eaters are recommended to worship the goddess Kali, the ghastly form of material nature, and before the goddess, the sacrifice of animals is recommended. But for those who are in the mode of goodness, the transcendental worship of Vishnu is recommended. But ultimately, all yajñas are meant for gradual promotion to the transcendental position. For ordinary men, at least, five yajñas, known as Panchamaha Yajna, are necessary. One should know, however, that all the necessities of life that the human society requires are supplied by the demigod agents of the Lord. No one can manufacture anything. Take, for example, all the eatables of human society. These eatables include grains, fruits, vegetables, milk, sugar, etc., for the persons in the mode of goodness, and also eatables for the non-vegetarians, like meats, none of which can be manufactured by men. Then again, take, for example, heat, light, water, air, etc., which are also necessities of life. None of them can be manufactured by the human society. Without the Supreme Lord, there could be no profuse sunlight, moonlight, rainfall, breeze, etc., without which no one can live. Obviously, our life is dependent on supplies from the Lord. Even for our manufacturing enterprises, we require so many raw materials like metal, sulfur, mercury, manganese, and so many essentials, all of which are supplied by the agents of the Lord, with a purpose that we should make proper use of them to keep ourselves fit and healthy for the purpose of self-realization, leading to the ultimate goal of life, namely liberation from the material struggle for existence. This aim of life is attained by performance of yajñas. If we forget the purpose of human life and simply take supplies from the agents of the Lord for sense gratification and become more and more entangled in material existence, which is not the purpose of creation, certainly we become thieves, and therefore we are punished by the laws of material nature. A society of thieves can never be happy because they have no aim in life. The gross materialist thieves have no ultimate goal of life. They are simply directed to sense gratification, nor do they have knowledge of how to perform yajñas. Lord Chaitanya, however, inaugurated the easiest performance of yajña, namely the Sankirtan yajña, which can be performed by anyone in the world who accepts the principles of Krishna consciousness. So this is sort of the basic outline of the system, you know, that Krishna has set up for supplying the necessities of human civilization. There are these authorized agents, the demigods, but they're simply agents. They're not the supreme themselves. They just have particular functions. Now, Veda Vyasa was telling about like a big argument like that exploded in a preaching engagement that he was at. That some were saying, no, Krishna's supreme. Some were saying, Shiva's supreme. And the question really, I think a lot depends upon what authority people are accepting. Because if they accept the Vedic literature, then we can begin to argue on the basis of Bhagavad Gita, because all Hindus generally accept the Bhagavad Gita. It's the Gita Upanishad. So then we can draw their attention to some of these different verses that we're going to be hearing about tomorrow also. Because these are the essential verses where Krishna explains what this system of demigod worship is, what its shortcomings are, and what the real system actually is. So does anyone have any final questions or comments on this Veda Vyasa?
Sometimes we feel that Shiva is supreme. Shiva is supreme.
Yeah.
And one person was giving me a quote to show that, of course, in Shiva Brahma, you feel that Shiva is God. But there is this statement that says that the eyes worship, the wings worship of Vishnu, and higher than that, Lord Shiva, and higher than that is the worship of those things related to Vishnu, like Lord Shiva.
Well, that's what they say. So that's a very famous verse. Aradhananam sarvesham Vishnu aradhanam param tasmaparataram devi tadiyanam samarchanam. So they offer that interpretation of it.
Well, to worship Shiva
in relationship to Lord Krishna
is
authorized.
Maybe that
in Vrindavan here, they worship
Shiva
in relationship to Lord Krishna.
Yes, protector
of the Dham
and protector of Krishna's
pastimes.
So that's all right if they want to worship in that way. Just as long as they understand
that worship of Vishnu is the highest,
and then if you want to worship things in relationship to Vishnu or Krishna,
and that's also nice. Well, to worship Shiva in relationship to Lord Krishna is authorized. They do that in Vrindavan here. You know, they worship Shiva in relationship to Lord Krishna. He is protector of the Dham and protector of Krishna's pastimes. So that's all right if they want to worship in that way, just as long as they understand that worship of Vishnu is the highest, and then if you want to worship things in relationship to Vishnu or Krishna, then that's also nice. It's called Shiva Tattva. It's not a Jiva. Jiva Tattva, as the rest of the demigods are. But he's there for a specific purpose, however. It's to deal with the material energy.
But he has his form, his Vishnu form. Forearm form, he has a Vaikuntha plan. Mm. As Vishnu. That means we have to be gentle with that.
Okay.
If somebody creates concocts his own method of worship, and you know, it seriously follows that, you get any benefit from that. Because that authorized.
Well, Krishna says, and this is, I forget which verse it is exactly, but Krishna says these actually are all kinds of, you know, he says if somebody desires to worship in some particular way, then Krishna will make his faith strong in that. You know, just like even the materialist, you know, they want to, you know, they have faith that, you know, by having all these industries and technologies, they'll create a heaven on earth. You know, so Krishna gives them the faith to do that. So Krishna will give, you know, we see there are so many varieties of worship all over the world. People worshiping so many things. That's the purpose of this course. But Krishna says, "Yeah, you tam up about you take tams to tayo bhajamiha." From, you know, as they surrender up to me, you know, I'll reward them accordingly. And he also says, from me comes memory, knowledge, and forgetfulness. So, and then he says, I'll give them the faith, you know, to carry out their activities. Even the materialists, you know, Krishna gives them the faith, you know, that yes, that somehow or other, yes, we'll conquer the universe. You know, we'll do it somehow. Of course, he also gives the devotees of the Lord the faith that you know, they can win over all of these. Because this was Lord Chaitanya's special purpose, was to just flood the entire universe with love of Godhead. And even those people who are just running to escape the waves of his mercy, he'd be thinking, you know, how to entangle them, you know, how to capture them somehow or other, you know, even if they're running away from it. So his followers of Lord Chaitanya were like that. Okay, so class time is over. There'll be more discussion of demigods tomorrow. We can continue with this. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. About, you know, it's said the demigods don't come to this planet anymore because, you know, the sacrifices to them aren't being performed properly. In Vedic times, you know, when they had these brahmanas that could, you know, light fire by mantra and things like that, the demigods would actually come. But the reason that people would worship them is they could get material results very quickly, relatively speaking, by, you know, this demigod worship. And they could also get a very, in the future, you know, they could see the possibility of getting transferred to the planets of the demigods, not just getting some benedictions in this life, but going to the planets of the demigods and getting a very high grade of sense gratification. It's like
it's described that, you know, the demigods, you know, they live for a much longer period of time. Their standard of enjoyment is higher. In one place, in the Bhagavatam, it says that in Treta Yuga, conditions on the earth were pretty much like they were in the heavenly planets. And one thing that's mentioned is that in terms of sex life, things were more like what things are in the heavenly planets. So at that time, well, the demigods, apparently, they can engage in sex life, their women, for their entire life, and then only at the very end, you know, they have one child, and, you know, that's it. So it said that in Treta Yuga, the same situation was here on the earth. So sometimes I reflect that what people are trying to do with all this abortion and contraception and everything, they're trying to, you know, recreate, you know, in some artificial way the situation that the demigods have. Of course, even the situation that the demigods have in terms of that higher grade material opulence and sense gratification, that's still not, you know, the ultimate goal of life, because that's still within the material range. But anyways, we'll try to go over some of these things today. Now, I think some of you had some comments yesterday that you didn't get to make. Did anybody want to carry on from yesterday, some of the things that we were talking about? Did anybody want to say something that they didn't get a chance to say? King Ramachandra?
Yesterday when Rudy asked that Lord Ramachandra also worshipped Lord Shiva.
Where's that from? Is that from Ramayana? Is that from Ramayana?
Yes.
That's in Ramayana?
Yes.
Okay.
So, and if you say that Lord Ramachandra appeared in this planet to teach householders what is the duty of wife, what is the duty of children, what is the duty of parents, what is the duty of brother, sister, like this. What is the duty of citizens? He came on that day. So when he was going to attack Lanka, at that time he worshipped Shiva. But that was not an example that Lord Ramachandra worshipped Lord Shiva every day. Because Bhagavatam also says how that Lord Shiva is the best one devotee.
Uh-huh. Vaishnavanam
Yathashambhu. So, in this connection, if we say that Lord Shiva is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, this thinking will be wrong.
Yeah. Well, these are intricate questions. Even in the Bhagavatam, sometimes Lord Shiva is addressed as Bhagavan. And there are many intricacies there. And if you read Chaitanya Charitamrita, for example, you'll see there's a Vishnu expansion named Sadashiva, who's in a Vaikuntha planet. Of course, that's not the Shiva of this world. Shiva expands from this Vishnu form in the spiritual world. But then Brahma Samhita, Acharya has explained that when that expansion comes, it's like milk turning into yogurt. The milk can turn into the yogurt, but you can't turn the yogurt back into the milk. So at that point, and ultimately everyone's an expansion from Vishnu or Krishna. We're expansions, everyone is. Yeah, so, but we're not the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because there are different categories of expansions. So this Shiva Tattva, it's considered between the Vishnu Tattva and between the Jiva Tattva. It's intermediate position, not Vishnu Tattva, not jiva tattva, but somewhat in between. Now that's the general explanation that's given. So these are intricate matters, but the basic point, you know, we're talking about here is we're not, generally speaking, 99.9% of the people we're encountering are not in this category who are thinking of all these intricacies. You know, they're thinking there's a demigod, Shiva, who I can get material benefits from, and they may think. So this is what we're concerned with, and it's not Shiva we're concerned with. We're concerned with the people who think that this person is exactly equal or even superior to Krishna. That's why there's the second offense to the holy name. You have to consider the names of the demigods like Brahma, Shiva, and others to be equal to the name of Lord Krishna, or the injunctions of the Shastra. You know, that anyone who considers Brahma, Rudradi, Daivitai, Samadvaita, that's, if they consider to be equal to Krishna, then that's not correct. It's not any reflection on Shiva or Sadashiva or Shambhu or Rudra. There are many different manifestations. But principally here in Bhagavad Gita, we're concerned with those who are looking towards Shiva as a source of material benediction and want to equate him with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yep.
On this question of what from Jindra worshiping on Shiva, I heard the one brother had a soul pilgrimage. He was asked the same question, and he answered that in that this.
Whose class was it?
Suhajalara.
Okay.
And he said that this story only appears in Tulsi's Ramayana and other Bhagavad Gita.
Okay, that's why I was asking where it was coming from. So. Was it from which Ramayana do you recall it from?
Generally, Tulsidasa.
Oh, okay.
But that is not written in Valmiki Ramayana.
Okay. All right. So, like I said, these are intricate matters, and we can discuss them, but no matter what one thinks, even if Shiva is sometimes addressed as Bhagavan, even in the Bhagavatam, he's addressed like that sometimes. But Prabhupada explains why he's addressed like that, because he's actually a Brahma, and Shiva, they're considered guna avatars. They're among the avatars of Vishnu. So sometimes it just depends how exactly you're going to look at the question. But however you look at it, even if you want to say, sometimes he's addressed as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but then there's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even if you want to look at it that way. Even in Chaitanya Charitamrita, it says this Sadashiva considers himself servant of Krishna. So, this is the main point. However you look at it, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So did anybody else have anything they wanted to say yesterday that they didn't get a chance to say? Okay. So today I want to go over a few more of the verses in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna describes demigod worship, the reasons for it, the effects of it. 4:12, chapter 4, text 12, this is where Krishna is describing this idea that I was mentioning before. They want quick results. So in 4:12, this is where Krishna explains this. He says, men in this world desire success and fruitive activities, and therefore they worship the demigods. Quickly, of course, men get results from fruitive work in this world. In his purport, we won't read the whole thing, but there's some interesting points in here. There's a great misconception about the gods or demigods of this material world, and men of less intelligence, although passing as great scholars, take these demigods to be various forms of the Supreme Lord. Actually, the demigods are not different forms of God, but they are God's different parts and parcels. God is one, and the parts and parcels are many. The Vedas say, Nityo Nityanam, God is one. Ishvara Parma Krishna, the Supreme God is one, Krishna. And the demigods who are delegated with powers to manage this, and the demigods are delegated with powers to manage this material world. These demigods are all living entities, Nityanam, with different grades of material power. They cannot be equal to the Supreme God, Narayan, Vishnu, or Krishna. Anyone who thinks that God and the demigods are on the same level is called an atheist or a Pashundi. Even the great demigods, like Brahma and Shiva, cannot be compared to the Supreme Lord. In fact, the Lord is worshipped by demigods such as Brahma and Shiva, Shiva Varinji Nutsam. Yet, curiously enough, there are many human leaders who are worshipped by foolish men under the misunderstanding of anthropomorphism or zoomorphism. Anyway, so that's going on to another point, how sometimes even ordinary human beings are worshipped to get results. Now, in 429, I think I must have written down the wrong number there. Okay, so cross that one off your list because that refers to something else.
This is my second
letter. Oh. Yeah.
Do we say
the Mika, the My God? I think English is one of those languages where it's not like Sanskrit where there's one way to pronounce every word. Some will say demigods, demigods. Demigods is American. That's American English. And demigods is English? English. Okay, differences between, and I think the Australians would probably have a different way to say it. What do they say? They say demigods? Yeah, it must be hard to learn English pronunciation. Because there's no connection between how things are spelled and how they sound. Right? So, 7:20, starting on 7:20, these are the most important verses about some of the more important verses about, like, the demigods, starting on 7:20. And there, these are the most famous verses, Kamais Taistar Hrittigyana, Prapadyante Nyadevata, Tamtam Niyama Mashtaya, Prakrita Niyataswaya. Those whose intelligence has been stolen by material desires surrender unto demigods and follow the particular rules and regulations of worship according to their own nature. And then the next verse, Krishna explains, I am in everyone's heart, as the super soul, as soon as one desires to worship some demigod, I make his faith steady so that he can devote himself to that particular deity. So if we go through these verses, we can see that Krishna is giving a lot of psychological information, really confidential information about how he operates, how he reciprocates with different souls, how he makes their faith steady
in different objects of worship so that they can devote themselves to their particular deity. This is a very important point. We've seen how Krishna says people worship these demigods because they want quick results. And then Krishna says, I give them the faith to do that. Of course, even though he's also said, only those whose intelligence has been stolen by material desires surrender unto these demigods and follow the particular rules and regulations of worship according to their own natures. So in his purport here, Srila Prabhupada says, God has given independence to everyone. Therefore, if a person desires to have material enjoyment and wants very sincerely to have such facilities from the material demigods, the Supreme Lord is Supersoul in everyone's heart, understands and gives facilities to such persons. So Krishna doesn't interfere with our independence. Of course, then a little bit later on in the purport, Prabhupada explains, both the living entity and the demigods are subordinate to the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, the living entity cannot worship the demigod by his own desire. That's interesting. You know, Prabhupada saying that, therefore, the living entity cannot worship the demigod by his own desire, nor can the demigod bestow any benediction without the supreme will. As it is said, not a blade of grass moves without the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Generally, persons who are distressed in the material world go to the demigods as they are advised in the Vedic literature. A person wanting some particular thing may worship such and such a demigod. For example, a diseased person is recommended to worship the sun god. A person wanting education may worship the goddess of learning, Sarasvati. And a person wanting a beautiful wife may worship the goddess Uma, the wife of Lord Shiva. In this way, there are recommendations in the Shastras, Vedic scriptures, for different modes of worship of different demigods. So then, in the next verse, Krishna says, endowed with such faith, he endeavors to worship a particular demigod and obtains his desires, but in actuality, these benefits are bestowed by me alone. And in the next verse, Krishna says, men of small intelligence worship the demigods, and their fruits are limited and temporary. Those who worship the demigods go to the planets of the demigods, but my devotees ultimately reach my supreme planet. Then, in text 30, chapter 7, text 30, Krishna says, those in full consciousness of me, who know me, the Supreme Lord, to be the governing principle of the material manifestation of the demigods and of all methods of sacrifice, can understand and know me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even at the time of death. So there, Krishna is saying, he's the governing principle of these demigods. They're part of the system of universal management that Krishna has developed. And you know, I just think it's kind of interesting historically. You know, if you look in the Vedic literature, it says that up to the time of Buddha, which according to your standard historical accounts would be about 600 BC or something like that, that this process of demigod worship was in full flower. You know, in other words, the people were performing proper sacrifices and things like that. And then after that, they stopped getting results, I think in the same way that they had been getting previously. Although it still continues, it's still, you know, going on in some places and in some fashion. But you know, it's kind of interesting that if you go back in history, you'll see that actually all over the world, you had the Egyptians and the Babylonians and others, the Vikings and people like that, they were all engaged in this demigod worship. Even when I was in Russia this last summer, some devotees were showing me some books written by Russian scholars, showing how Vedic demigods were worshipped in Russia thousands of years ago. But so it seems very interesting that in many places around the world you have this had this phenomenon going, and then it seemed to die out in most places, these worship of these higher demigods in charge of different forces of nature seem to die out at a certain time, roughly when the Vedas say it should have been dying out, when the proper sacrifices stopped being performed. And then you have these other religious systems come in, like Christianity and Islam and Buddhism, like that. But going on, so starting on with9:20. This, in these verses, Krishna's kind of describing the motives of some people for this demigod worship, because they want the higher levels of sense gratification. In 9:20, Krishna says, "Those who study the Vedas and drink the soma juice, seeking the heavenly planets, worship me indirectly. Purified of sinful reactions, they take birth on the pious heavenly planet of Indra, where they enjoy godly delights." When they have thus enjoyed vast heavenly sense pleasure, and the results of their pious activities are exhausted, they return to this mortal planet again. Thus, those who seek sense enjoyment by adhering to the principles of the three Vedas achieve only repeated birth and death. But those who always worship me with exclusive devotion, meditating on my transcendental form, to them I carry what they lack and I preserve what they have. And in your notes, you can note that from 9:20, this series of verses goes up to 9:23. And there Krishna says in 9:23, "Those who are devotees of other gods and who worship them with faith actually worship only me, O son of Kunti, but they do so in the wrong way." That's avidhi purvikam, in the wrong way. They're actually worshiping Krishna, but in the wrong way. Actually, this series of verses goes actually up to 9:25. In 9:24, Krishna says, "I am the only enjoyer and master of all sacrifices. Therefore, those who do not recognize my true transcendental nature fall down." And then in text 9:25, "Those who worship the demigods will take birth among the demigods. Those who worship the ancestors go to the ancestors. Those who worship ghosts and spirits will take birth among such beings. And those who worship me will live with me." So there's different results for the different kinds of worship. Then in 17:4, there's a description of how the worship of different You know, we've already considered this verse, but it also applies to the section on the demigods. So, men in the mode of goodness worship the demigods, those in the mode of passion worship the demons, and those in the mode of ignorance worship ghosts and spirits. So if we go through these, we see, you know, Krishna's explaining what demigod worship is. He's explaining the motives for it, and he's explaining the results of it, and he's also giving reasons why it shouldn't be done. You know, he's saying, you know, he's giving reasons why, you know, it's not so good, you know, to worship the demigods. So you can see that sort of fits into, you know, he describes the process of worship, what it is, what the advantage, perceived advantage is, what the disadvantage is, and then he offers arguments, you know, against it. Now, as I was mentioning yesterday, I want to make some, look at this article in Back to Godhead magazine that has to do with this this subject. And this makes it clear that this, that these kinds of issues that we're talking about aren't just, you know, theoretical or, you know, something that maybe was happening, you know, thousands of years ago and isn't of much relevance for us today. If you know, as Krishna consciousness expands more and more in society, you know, we're going to be in different areas of the world, and, you know, different devotees who are engaged in different kinds of preaching. You know, we're going to run into these things, just as we've seen in our own, you know, personal lives. We're going to be running into atheists and materialists of various kinds. We're going to be running into people who want to equate Krishna with the demigods. We're going to be running into, like, ghost and spirit and demon worshippers. I mean, these things are all there. And Krishna talks about them in the Bhagavad Gita. So, this, In Back to Godhead magazine for a few issues last year, they were running some articles about the demigods. And even though they were very nice articles, you know, they were just saying, basically, yes, here's a demigod, you know, Sarasvati or Ganesh or Lakshmi or Indra or whatever, Brahma, Shiva, and explaining, yes, these are servants of Krishna and we can respect them as such, but Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it actually touched off quite a bit of controversy. Of course, some people don't like controversy. I tend to like controversy. I think it's a good thing, not a bad thing. It kind of shows that you're alive and functioning and you actually are saying something. And actually, Srila Prabhupada put a great deal of emphasis upon, you know, challenging, you know, these different ideas, whether he was talking about the materialistic scientist or the impersonalist or even these demigod worshippers. He did strongly present, you know, the proper philosophy. So we should also learn to do that. And I think Back to Godhead's been doing a nice job in that regard. It's one thing. The reason I like this particular article, say it's one thing, you know, just to say, write some article about this. You know, just, all right, you know, Krishna is superior to the demigods, this, that, the other. But when you actually start getting responses, you know, from people who want to argue the other point of view, and then it shows that you're actually having some effect. You've actually engaged, you know, then it's no longer just something theoretical. You've actually engaged, you know, the people who hold the view, you know, that you're talking about. And then you've got an opportunity to change their minds or convince the minds of other people who may be listening and thinking about these things. So, as time goes on, I think a lot of the things that we just say in our own company, you know, in our Bhagavad Gita classes and Bhagavatam classes, you know, we're going to find we're actually going to be actually engaged in dialogue or debate with people who actually hold these philosophies. Of course, that means that we have to be very prepared. Because it's one thing to, you know, just talk about these things among ourselves, but then when you actually have to deal with people who actually hold these views, then you know, then you have to be very expert. And that's why Srila Prabhupada wanted his devotees to study his books very carefully for our own spiritual advancement, but also to be able to convince others of the logical superiority of the system of, you know, bhakti yoga and of the principle of a supreme personality of Godhead. So I thought this was this is only one of a few, I think, responses. It's sort of been an ongoing thing in Back to Godhead magazine. But this is like a letter from R.T. Satya, president of the Cambridge University Hindu Society, Cambridge, in the United Kingdom. So he says, this letter is a response to your article, "Is Back to Godhead an Offender?" As a young Hindu living in Britain, where the media consistently portrays religion as fanatical, it is upsetting when it seems that Hindu sects, such as ISKCON, for whom I have great regard and respect, do propound such rigid views which are in direct opposition to the universal tolerance of Sanatan Dharma. When these intolerant views are propagated within the body of this eternal faith, it is even more distressing and worrying. I myself am a Krishna Bhakta and believe that Krishna is the supreme Godhead who takes on different manifestations, is called by different names, but is essentially the one true Brahman. However, I also truly believe that those devotees who call him Allah, Jesus, Jehovah, etc., and certainly those who call him Shiva or Brahma, worship one and the same God. So he's sort of right up to a point, but, you know, there's like a line that you cross over, you know, in your attempts to become universally tolerant, where you cross over the line of what's true and what's not true, what's right and what's wrong. So you see, it's like a nice sentiment. So he goes, thus, in quoting Gita 9:23, "Ye piyanya devata bhakta, yajante shradayanvita, tepi mam eva kauntaya, yajante avidhi purvikam," in support of your argument, I believe you are grossly misrepresenting what the Lord says here. I hasten to stress that I myself am in my third year of a Sanskrit degree, and so I'm not talking without foundation. I give here another translation of the verse. So he offers his own translation of this verse. Kaunteya, even those devotees who endowed with faith worship other gods with some interested motive, worship me alone, though with a mistaken approach. Now, I, upon reading this, came to an entirely different conclusion to yours. To me, when Krishna says that the approach is mistaken, he means it is wrong to consider your chosen deity as the only supreme and others as inferior. If the devotee
i.e. if the devotee worships Shiva and does not accept Krishna as one and the same when they are in reality, then they are mistaken. So anyways, he's offering his own translation of this verse, which is to say, the mistake is to think that only Krishna is supreme and not everyone else is. I agree vehemently with, for example, those Christians who believe Jesus is the Son of God and the only... Oh, he says, I disagree vehemently with, for example, those Christians who believe Jesus is the Son of God in the only way, and worshippers of other faiths are misled, ignorant, and damned. God is one, and he is not so petty, as you seem to imply, that if you call him Shiva with full faith and devotion, while at the same time accepting that others call him Krishna, etc., he would be displeased. Indeed, in the Ramcharitamanas, Rama says, he who has no devotion for the lotus feet of Lord Shiva, and even in his dreams, will not be tolerated by Lord Rama.